found the body, informing the police about it. Or they'd pretend to have valuable information about the case. It was a way to siphon information, and they also often erroneously believed it put them beyond suspicion. There was definitely a measure of superiority in that kind of behavior. "I think you're right," she said.
"Let's not wait for him to do it. We need to start a volunteer hotline. Say we're looking for any info that might prove useful about the Nicole Medina case, and then the police can check the people that call as well as the leads. He might call."
Zoe considered this. "I think that's a good idea. We should suggest it." A silence settled between them. For a few minutes, they had a taste of their previous bond. But now that the discussion was over, the tension was there again. "I need to call Maribel Howe's mother," Zoe muttered, rummaging in her bag for her phone. "I want to know exactly." The words faded as she gaped at the display. She'd set it to silent when they'd visited Dr. Cobb and had forgotten about it. She had 2 missed calls from Harry Berry, 3 from Andrea, and 1 from Mancuso, as well as a message from Andrea asking Zoe to call her back urgently. She was dizzy as she dialed Andrea, listening to it ring, praying for her to answer already. Finally, Andrea said, "Hey." Zoe's heart plunged, hearing her sister's voice. She'd clearly been crying, and her breathing was heavy, frightened.
"Ray Ray, what happened?"
"I saw Glover."
"Are you all right? Did he?"
"He didn't touch me. I saw him stalking me while I was at the gym. It was him, so I'm sure of it."
"Of course you're sure. I didn't think otherwise. Where are you now?"
"I'm at the apartment. I locked the door."
Andrea hiccuped.
"A patrol officer took me home and made sure the place was empty before he left."
"Did you talk to Agent Caldwell?"
"Yeah, I called him."
"What did he say?"
"He said the police will check the security cameras at the gym."
"Is there someone keeping watch for you right now?"
I don't know. I don't think so."
Zoe leaned against the wall, feeling helpless and furious with herself. What was she doing all the way across the country from Andrea? Her sister needed her right now.
"Listen, I'll get home as fast as possible. I'll catch the first plane, okay? For now, I'll talk to Mancuso. Make sure there's someone watching the place at all times. Did you latch the door as well?"
"Yes."
"And latch the windows too, okay?"
"There's nothing to worry about, Ray Ray. He won't get near you. Can you explain what happened exactly?"
Zoe paced back and forth as she listened, ignoring Tatum's worried stare, her mind in an uproar. Glover was watching her sister, clearly stalking her. Had he been doing it the entire time? Did he intend to hurt her sister, or was he just getting a thrill from watching her? Stupid question. Glover was way past voyeurism. If he stalked a woman, it meant he fantasized about attacking her, and Glover acted on his fantasies. She needed to keep Andrea safe. Maybe they could get her to a safe house, or fly her out of the country for a few months until Zoe could catch Glover, tear his eyes out, castrate him, and force-feed him his own.
"Hello? Zoe, are you there?"
"I'm here. Okay, Ray Ray, stay inside. Keep everything locked. I'll talk to Mancuso and get a flight out."
"Okay. I took your chef's knife."
It took Zoe a moment to figure out the context of what her sister had just said.
"Oh. Okay.
I'll sleep with it. Just in case."
"Just be careful with it."
"I'll put it under the pillow."
"The way you toss around in your sleep, you'll end up impaling yourself with it."
Andrea let out a shuddering laugh.
"Hang in there. I'll call you back in a bit, okay?"
She hung up. Tatum looked at her.
"Zoe, what?"
"Hang on." She dialed Mancuso. The chief answered after 2 rings.
"Zoe."
"Glover was watching Andrea. He was in the same room with her."
"We're checking it out. Calm down. Caldwell is there right now looking at the security feed.
You need to send someone to keep an eye on Andrea. She's all alone in my apartment. All alone. He could go there at any moment, Mancuso, and she won't."
"Bentley, get a grip."
Zoe shut up, surprised.
"There's a patrol car watching the entrance to your building right now. An officer already searched your apartment carefully. No one is letting anything happen to Andrea. Okay?"
"She didn't know you were watching," Zoe muttered lamely.
"Your sister is scared out of her wits. I doubt she heard half of what Caldwell told her on the phone. She isn't a professional, and no one expects her to function under pressure. unlike you.
Zoe ignored the remark, tapping on her keyboard, searching for flight tickets.
I'm flying back, she told Mancuso. I can get on a plane tomorrow morning.
She expected the chief to argue with her, but Mancuso just sighed.
Fine. I doubt you have a lot more to do in San Angelo in any case. Gray can stay an extra day to help out the local police.
Thanks. Andrea will be fine, Zoe. Zoe didn't answer. Mancuso said goodbye and hung up. Zoe put down the phone.
What's going on? Tatum asked.
Andrea saw Glover. He was stalking her.
Zoe began to insert her details for the flight ticket.
Is she all right?
Yeah.
She's scared. I'll send Marvin over so she won't be alone.
Thanks.
I'm going back there first thing in the morning. Mancuso said you should probably stay another day to wrap things up here.
Okay.
A second of silence.
Do you want me to drop you off at the motel?
I'm fine. I'll take an Uber. You should go tell Foster about your hotline. It's a good idea.
Tatum cleared his throat.
I'm sure Andrea will be fine.
Zoe shut the laptop screen and stood up.
That's what Mancuso told me. I wish I knew where you two get your information.
Chapter 35. By the time Tatum had filled Foster in about the latest development and told him about the hotline, Zoe was already gone. Tatum almost called her to ask how Andrea was doing, but decided to avoid bothering her. Instead, he walked out of the station and called Marvin.
Guess what I did today, Tatum?
His grandfather said without preamble. Tatum could think of a bunch of options, none of them particularly good.
What? I skydived.
Tatum groaned.
What about the insurance? I found a company that agreed to insure me. It cost me an arm and a leg, but you can do without my inheritance, right?
I don't care about the damn inheritance. I just want you to be around for a while, and
I paid with your credit card, Tatum. Mine didn't work for some reason.
Tatum shut his eyes and lost himself to some calming, murderous thoughts.
I'll pay you back, don't worry, Marvin said. And I got a discount for next time.
Next? Marvin, there's no next.
I'm hooked, Tatum. You won't believe how great it feels. It's better than cocaine. It's almost better than sex. The only problem is it's short, Tatum. The free fall is less than a minute. Free fall, that's what we jumpers call the time between jumping and the moment the parachute opens. Georgette says I'm a natural.
Who's Georgette?
The instructor. We jump together. You should see her, Tatum. She's fantastic. If I was 40 years younger.
Marvin, listen. Andrea just saw Rod Glover. He was stalking her.
Aw, shit. Did he touch her?
No, but he was very close. Could you drop by, see how she's doing?
Sure thing, Tatum. I'll get there right now. Poor kid. She must be terrified. How's Zoe doing?
Shocked and worried. She went to the motel. She's flying back tomorrow.
And where are you?
I'm at the police station. I need to finish up with some stuff.
What's wrong with you, Tatum? Go help your partner. She needs someone to be there for her. She's probably worried sick.
Thanks for your concern. Just see to Andrea.
Tatum, listen to me. Go be with Zoe. I don't care if you think she's fine. Trust me, she's not.
You don't know her. She's the strongest person I know, and
I swear your dad was an awesome kid, but he had no idea how to raise you. Go be with your damn partner.
Tatum rolled his eyes. His grandfather was driving him insane.
Look, she's better without me anyway. We had an argument a few days ago, and it's a bit complicated right now. So I appreciate the advice, but
what kind of argument?
It doesn't matter.
What kind of argument, Tatum?
Just some dumb stuff, she said. I told her about the case in L.A., the one where I shot the pedophile.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
The internal investigation has been reopened. Apparently there's a new witness.
They're acting like shooting pedos is against the law.
It is against the law. Anyway, Zoe said maybe I didn't shoot in self-defense, that I shot him because I thought it was the right thing to do.
Yeah? So what did you argue about?
Tatum frowned.
That's what we argued about. Oh, I get it,
Marvin finally said.
You were hurt.
Well, yeah.
You thought she should know you better than that. I understand how you feel. You care about what she thinks of you.
Of course I do.
Tatum kicked a small rock and it hit the station's wall.
Anyway, I should probably let her be alone. She doesn't need this right now.
Uh-huh. But listen, Tatum.
Yeah?
Are you a man or a wimp?
What?
Are you spineless? Are you a damn wuss? She hurt your delicate snowflake feelings. Is that what's the matter? You're lucky I'm not there, Tatum, or I'd do what your father should have done and wallop your ass.
Listen, Marvin.
Did you lose your balls, Tatum?
Marvin roared.
Did the vet accidentally take them off when you had Freckle castrated? Should I call the vet and ask for your balls back? Would that help you get over yourself and act like a man? What's wrong with you? Grow a damn spine and a pair of new balls and go be with your partner. She needs your support, damn it.
Grandpa, shut up!
Tatum shouted back.
I'm doing what I think is right. You don't know her like I do, and...
You're doing nothing right, Tatum. You get in your car and you drive over there. And you comfort your friend. You got that? And I'm going over to see her sister because one of us still remembers what it is to be a man.
The line clicked as Marvin hung up the phone. Tatum nearly tossed his mobile on the ground. He shook with rage. That stubborn, daft old man and his old-fashioned, clueless advice. What the hell did he know about anything? He had no idea. It was easy to yell and rant, but the bastard didn't even know Zoe, had no idea what made her tick. Zoe was the kind of person who needed time for herself. Tatum knew that. Marvin should respect his ability to know his partner. Maybe she'd want some food, though. He should get her some takeout. Just hand it to her. Ask her if she needed anything else. Wouldn't hurt to ask. He drove in furious silence, passing the time by thinking of things he could shout at Marvin next time they spoke. It took him some time until he found a restaurant that did takeout with reasonable-looking dishes. He got Zoe a nice hamburger and some fries. He then went to the nearby grocery and bought a six-pack. She would probably need the drink. And if she did want company, they could drink together. She wouldn't, but it was better to buy it, just in case. The sun was low over the horizon when he reached the motel. He climbed the stairs and went over to her door. He knocked, then knocked again. He glanced through the window. The room was dark.
She just left.
Tatum turned around to see a man walking toward him, smoking a cigarette.
What?
He asked.
You're looking for Zoe, right? I just saw her leave to grab some dinner. She had a guy with her. A giant, really. I think he was 7 feet tall.
Who the hell are you?
Harry Berry. Nice to meet you, Agent Gray.
Chapter 36. Zoe's apartment in Dale City had two bedrooms, and both bedrooms had windows overlooking the opposite building in the complex, as well as the footpath that led to the building's entrance. Andrea had latched the windows and shut the doors, positioning the couch in the living room so she could see both the entrance door and the living room window from the corners of her eyes. She now sat and stared at the TV, trying to concentrate on whatever transpired on screen, while gripping the large knife she'd taken from Zoe's kitchen. She occasionally glanced down at it, taking comfort in the shining, sharp blade. The sudden knock on the door drove her heart up to her throat. She glanced at the time. It was 10:15. She made sure the door was latched, though she'd already checked 6 times. She got up, knife in hand, and crept to it, praying that whoever it was would just go away. Another knock, harder this time. She winced and tried to call out, but all she could get out of her throat was a slight croak.
Excuse me, sir?
She heard a firm voice say beyond the door.
Can I help you?
It was probably the policeman watching the building's entrance. Agent Caldwell had called to tell her they'd checked the security footage and that there had definitely been someone looking at her, though it had been hard to identify his face. The agent had stressed several times that a policeman would be watching her home all night.
Sir,
the voice said again.
Can you step away from the door?
I'm here to visit Andrea Bentley,
a cranky voice answered.
Calm yourself, I'm not a goddamn serial killer.
Sir, please step away from the door.
Listen, young man, I get that you're enthusiastic about your job, but what are you doing? Put that down. Don't be ridiculous.
Andrea unlatched and unlocked the door and yanked it open. Tatum's grandfather stood by the door, his back to her, a bag over one shoulder and a fishbowl in the other. He faced a uniformed cop who held a gun in his hand, looking uncertain.
"It's all right," Andrea said hurriedly. "I know him."
"What did you think I was going to do?"
Marvin asked in a loud voice.
"Assault her with the goldfish?"
"Sorry, miss," the officer apologized. "I saw a man entering the building carrying suspicious packages and..."
"Suspicious? It's a fishbowl."
Marvin shook his head.
"Are you going to arrest the fish?"
"Thanks, officer."
Andrea smiled at him and opened the door wider. "Come in, Marvin." The old man shuffled into the apartment and Andrea closed the door behind him.
"Sorry."
Marvin put the bowl with a dazed-looking fish on the table.
"I called, but you didn't answer."
Andrea nodded dumbly. When he'd called, she'd been sobbing hysterically and wasn't in a state to answer the phone.
"I told my grandson I'd watch out for you,"
Marvin said.
"And I'd heard you had some troubles, so here I am."
"Thanks. You didn't need to.
Why did you bring the fish?"
"If I'm going to spend the night here, I can't leave the fish with the cat. It won't end well for one of them. So, it was either bring the fish or the cat, and the fish didn't give as much resistance."
Marvin lifted his arm, showing her three red claw marks that ran along his wrist. He then surveyed the room suspiciously.
"Do you have cats here?"
"No,"
Andrea said weakly.
"Right."
The old man unzipped his jacket and, to Andrea's horror, took out a large gun.
"Good thing that young cop didn't see this,"
he muttered, putting the gun on the table by the fishbowl.
"Now, where's the kitchen? I need a nice cup of tea, and I gotta tell you, I think you do too. You're as pale as a bedsheet."
You really don't need to spend the night here."
Andrea followed Marvin to the kitchen.
"The police are watching my apartment and..."
"Nonsense."
Marvin waved his hand.
"You can't stay alone right now. Don't worry, I'll sleep on the couch. Where does your sister keep her tea?"
"I'm not sure she has tea. Zoe drinks coffee."
"There are times for coffee, and there are times for tea."
He rummaged in one of the lower cupboards.
"Ah, there we go. How do you drink yours?"
Well...
"It's not a hard question. Either you drink it with 0 spoons of sugar, or 1 spoon, or 2 spoons, or, if you know what's good for you, 3 spoons.
1/2 spoon.
A bit of a wise ass, are you?"
He shook his head as he made the tea. Andrea glanced backward. The fish seemed to be eyeing the gun, as if it contemplated grabbing it. A beer bottle stood in the middle of the fishbowl, and it swam around it twice, then stopped in front of the gun again.
"It's not a goldfish," Andrea said.
"Eh?"
Marvin shuffled over to her with 2 steaming mugs of tea.
"You called it a goldfish earlier. It's not. It's a gourami."
"It's gold, isn't it?"
He sat by the kitchen table with both mugs, pushing one to the other side.
"Sit down, drink your tea. You've been through a nasty shock."
She sat down and sipped from the tea. He was right. She needed it. And the company. She felt her eyes moistening.
"How's your tea?"
"It's good,"
she croaked.
"I put 2 spoons of sugar in it."
He waggled his bushy eyebrows. Andrea snorted in laughter, then let out a sob. The old man patted her awkwardly on her hand.
"You're all right, aren't you? And I promise you that bastard isn't setting a foot near you while I'm around, okay?"
"Okay."
She wiped the tears with the back of her hand.
"You know what I did today? I skydived. What an experience. You can come with me next time. That minute of free fall until the canopy opens. Canopy is what we jumpers call the parachute. Anyway, it's not as scary as you'd think. It's just exhilarating. Georgette says I'm a natural."
She tried to smile and nod as he spoke. For the first time that day, she could relax. It was absurd, but the grumpy old man was just what she needed to feel a bit safer. And knowing he was about to sleep in the living room no matter what she said, made her believe she could maybe fall asleep at some point during the night as well. Chapter 37.
"You don't like your ice cream?"
The question penetrated Zoe's fugue. She blinked, gazed down at the plastic cup in front of her. There was ice cream in it, or at least something that used to be ice cream. She'd let the thing sit untouched in the cup, and the heat had melted it to a milky goo. One lone pink iceberg bobbing in a sea of orange. She wasn't even sure what flavors she'd asked for. Strawberry and lemon? She toyed with the spoon a bit, then raised her eyes to meet Joseph's. I'm not hungry.
What's hungry got to do with ice cream?
He grinned. His own plastic cup, which was decidedly larger, was completely empty. She'd asked to meet him to distract herself. She'd been pacing her motel room back and forth, her thoughts an endless spiral of worry and guilt. Finally, she'd texted Joseph asking him to pick her up. He'd shown up in less than 15 minutes. First, they'd eaten pad thai at Lemongrass before they'd wandered over for ice cream across the street. All food tasted like ash in her mouth, and Zoe wasn't entirely sure whether she'd uttered a complete sentence for the entirety of their date. The whole time, her mind projected thoughts about Andrea alone in the apartment, while Glover prowled in the vicinity. Zoe was no stranger to fear, but fear for herself was somehow different than fear for her sister. When her own life had been at risk, it propelled her forward, the survival instincts of fight or flight pushing her to save herself. But fearing for her sister was different. It was like her body was submerged in icy molasses, somehow slowing her down, her thoughts a jumble, chills constantly running through her. It made her useless. Now Joseph was eyeing her carefully.
I don't know you very well, but you seem like something is weighing you down tonight. Is anything wrong?
Zoe dropped her gaze, stirring the ice cream with the spoon, creating swirls of pink and yellow. Usually, she wanted control over her life. She hated when someone else called the shots for her. But right now, she didn't trust her own judgment. For once, she wanted someone else to take charge. There is a homicidal sexual predator stalking my sister, she said, the words feeling lumpy in her mouth, as if they had an unpleasant texture.
He's obsessed with me, and now he's targeting her.
Joseph blinked. Clearly, he'd expected something else. A complaint about a bad day at work, an ailing relative, or an unpleasant encounter in the supermarket. Zoe didn't know the statistics, but she was quite sure the number of romantic dates in which a personal acquaintance with a serial killer popped up was low. He didn't ask her if she was serious, or bolt, and run, or laugh nervously. She had to give him that. He seemed to think it through, as if wondering how one reacted in those situations. It wasn't in the usual small talk protocol. His eyebrows drew together.
How does he know you?
We were neighbors when I was a kid. She felt a sort of icy calm take over her. Facts she could deal with. Those were the stories of her past, not the horrors that might lurk in the future. He raped and killed three girls in my town. I was the one who pointed him out to the cops.
How old were you?
14. He ran a hand over his beard, holding her gaze. And now I do this for a living, she carried on. She found something cathartic about laying everything plainly on the table. I work for the FBI, in the Behavioral Analysis Unit. I'm a forensic psychologist, a profiler.
Like in Criminal Minds?
She sighed. Yes, but real. The TV series isn't very accurate. There'd been a time she'd loved watching Criminal Minds, pointing out all the absurdities.
You said you're here on business,
Joseph said after a second. Consulting with the local police.
About what?
About a murder.
That girl they found buried, near the Jackson Farm.
I don't know where the Jackson Farm is. He shook his head in disbelief.
This guy you mentioned, he's stalking your sister?
Yes.
But can't the police stop him?
They can watch ya, Zoe said. There's a patrol car in front of a building right now. But they can't stay there forever. They'll pull the surveillance sooner or later. In a month, in a year. And he'll be waiting for it. He's patient. He's been evading the police for over 20 years.
What are they going to do?
Whatever they'll do. Won't be enough. I'll have to do it. I have to catch him. She sighed. Can you take me to the motel, please? They drove back in silence. The motel wasn't far. She could have walked, but that would demand a measure of focus and orientation she wasn't sure she had tonight. He parked in the parking lot and opened the door on his side.
You don't have to.
I'll walk you to your door,
Joseph said resolutely. She shrugged and got out of the car. She led the way, focusing on her feet, trying to keep the frightening thoughts at bay. She gripped her key in her hand as she crossed the parking lot and climbed the stairs to her room.
Thanks. I'm sorry I've been such a...
She motioned vaguely.
Sorry for being me.
Joseph shoved his hands in his pockets, looking almost sheepish.
No need to apologize.
She unlocked the door, stepping into the room. She turned, about to say goodbye, her hand already on the doorknob. But once she closed that door, the thoughts would come swarming, buzzing and rattling in her skull. Like the ice cream swirls she'd had in the cup back at the store, it'd be a goopy soup. Helplessness, anxiety, and horrible what-ifs all mixed together, spinning endlessly in her mind, keeping sleep away.
Do you want to come in?
She asked. A pleading note had entered her voice. She couldn't help it. She didn't want to be alone. He furrowed his brow, surprised yet again. Somehow, this disastrous date had ended up in an invitation. He stepped in and she shut the door behind him. For a terrible moment, she thought he would start talking. But then his hand wrapped behind her back, pulling her closer to him. She stood on her tiptoes, her chest brushing against his, and she wrapped her arms around his neck. He didn't kiss her yet, just stared into her eyes. They stood in silence, and Zoe's brain did what it always did when life paused. It filled up with thoughts. She tried to guess how far Glover was from Andrea. No more than 3 miles, probably, waiting for the right moment, for them all to lay down their guard again. He was like a malignant, fatal tumor, waiting to erupt and destroy her sister. No way to find it and remove it. She shivered, and Joseph held her fast, his brow furrowed. As long as she focused on him, she could dim the volume of her own fears. Up close, she let her gaze roam over his features. The neatly trimmed beard, thick eyebrows, hazel eyes. His eyelashes turned blonde at the tips, and only up close did she realize how long they were. She pulled his face down and he pressed his mouth against hers. The kiss started off tentative, like they were both unsure how the other person felt. He held back, making sure she really wanted him, and that made her more forceful. She drew his lower lip between hers, sucking on it for just a moment. His fingers tightened on her waist. He smelled nice up close. Wood shavings and polish. She opened her mouth to deepen the kiss, and her tongue brushed against his. He picked her up and she let her thighs wrap around him as he carried her to the bed, as if she weighed nothing at all. It was just 3 steps away. Motel rooms were efficient for hookups that way, the bed never too far from the door. They fell onto the bed and it creaked under their weight. He pulled her into his lap, and she straddled him. His body was a sanctuary from her stormy thoughts. She could lose herself in this moment. And right now, losing herself sounded like the best idea in the world.
Chapter 38, San Angelo, Texas, Saturday, November 10th, 1990. Maine sat on his bed and exhaled heavily, gazing at the floor. The boy looked at her, wishing she'd go away. But that wouldn't happen anytime soon.
Do you want to play with my Legos?
He asked. He didn't want to play with her at all. But he knew from experience that his mother would later ask him what they'd done. He would have to demonstrate that he'd suggested a plethora of games, and Maine hadn't been interested in any of them. A good host always tried to entertain his guests, his mother told him every single time. He never pointed out that a host was someone who invited his guests over, not someone who was forced to have guests. Maine rolled her eyes, as if the mere suggestion that they play Legos bored her. Her real name was Charmaine, but he'd only heard it once, when her mother had been furious at her. The rest of the time, she was Maine. His mother and Maine's mother, Ruth, had been friends since high school. They met at least once a month, and Ruth always brought Maine with her. The two mothers would quickly tell them to go play, and they'd have to sit in his room or outside together. He hated it. He knew Maine hated it, since she'd told him several times. He had no idea why Ruth kept bringing her over. He wasn't even sure his mother enjoyed it.
Before they would visit, his mother inevitably complained to his father that Ruth would find some way to look down at her. And after they'd leave, he often heard his mother say she was never inviting Ruth over again. He used to feel a spark of hope when she said that. Not anymore. Ruth and Maine were a permanent fixture in his life, like going to the dentist or waking up for church on Sunday, or the basement closet punishments.
"We can play Monopoly,"
he suggested half-heartedly. Maine snorted.
"That's a game for little kids."
She was a year older than him, but she was almost a foot taller, and would often point that out when they met, demonstrating how the top of his head didn't even reach her chin. When she took the time to establish that fact, he would stand perfectly still, his eyes locked on her chest. It bulged just a bit through her shirt. He decided he'd covered his bases. He imagined the conversation with his mom in his head.
"What did you and Maine play?" she would ask,
her voice slightly tense, as it always was after meeting her dear friend.
"Nothing,"
he'd say, cleverly omitting Maine's refusal. If he started out by explaining that she didn't want to play anything, it sounded defensive.
"You have to suggest things to play,"
his mother would say. "A good host always tries to entertain his guests."
"I did suggest things,"
he would say.
"What did you suggest?"
"Monopoly and Legos."
"Check and mate." His mother would have nothing to say about that. Maine exhaled again. She wore a nice perfume, the same one she'd worn last time. Its scent had stayed after she'd left, and it almost made the visit worth it. He'd lain in his bed, thinking about her standing close to him, saying,
"Look, my chin doesn't even touch your head. You're the shortest boy I know."
Him standing motionless, staring at those bulges in her shirt. He turned away and began to sort the matchboxes on his desk. 15 matchboxes, his prized collection. He loved playing with them, always feeling the fascination growing in him when he thought about their contents. His own little pets. Beetles, spiders, cockroaches, but mostly flies. He'd catch them alive and put them in the matchboxes. Listen to the sounds as they scuttled in their tiny prisons. He'd put several in the same matchbox. The trick was, you open the box just a bit, sliding the new captive inside, shutting it once he was there. Sometimes he'd mix and match, a spider with three flies, a cockroach and a beetle together. Every once in a while, he would shake each box and listen. If it made no sound, he'd empty it on a little strip of toilet paper. Eventually, he'd make a small pile of little dead insects and just look at them, wondering how they'd felt, trapped in the box, constantly looking for a way out.
"What are those?"
The voice made him start. Maine stood behind him, leaning over his shoulder. He could smell her perfume.
"Just my collection of matchboxes."
He'd stacked all 15 boxes, one on top of the other, a tower of prisoners.
"It's not very big," she sniffed. "And they're all just the same type. Isn't a collection supposed to be different types of boxes?"
"I don't know."
"You know what I like to do?" she said. "I like to light match and burn. And then, when the flame almost reaches my finger, I grab them from the other side and flip them so they burn completely."
He licked his lips.
"Okay."
She still leaned over his shoulder, her billowy shirt touching his neck.
"Here, let me show you."
She grabbed the topmost box. He didn't say anything, completely paralyzed by the moment. She straightened and opened the box. Her eyes widened as two flies shot out, flying around the ceiling. The dark feet of a cockroach wiggled out of the box. She screamed, and the cockroach leaped out, climbing up Maine's head. She shook her hand and stumbled, falling, knocking the tower of matchboxes to the floor. Still screeching, she stumbled to the door, yanked it open, and ran outside. He didn't move, didn't breathe. Around him, dozens of prisoners scuttled and buzzed, their limbs and wings scratching against the cardboard walls of their cells. Chapter 39. San Angelo, Texas. Friday, September 9th, 2016. The alarm woke Tatum up seconds after he had drifted into sleep. At least, that was what it felt like. Dazed, he fumbled for the phone, knocking it off the night table and under the bed in one clumsy swipe. The alarm got louder. Tatum had recently downloaded an alarm app that was designed for heavy sleepers.
It couldn't be snoozed, and to stop it, he had to punch in a 6-digit code. Its volume increased every few seconds. He had no idea what had prompted him to invite such a malicious entity into his life. He got out of bed and crouched to get to the phone. He had somehow managed to knock the phone all the way to the center of the space beneath the bed, just far enough that it would be a nightmare to reach from all sides. He had to stretch hard to get it, nearly dislocating his shoulder in the process. The alarm was now blaring so loud it had probably managed to wake up several of the adjacent rooms as well. His fingers snagged the phone, and he pulled it out groaning. He tapped the required 6 digits, and the vile thing finally went quiet. He sat on the floor, holding it, recuperating from the traumatic wake-up call. He sent Zoe a short message.
Need a ride to the airport?
Putting the phone aside, he began dressing. Halfway through putting on his socks, he paused, one foot still bare, the remaining sock bunched in his hand. Zoe hadn't responded yet. The night before, after lying awake in bed, thinking about Marvin's reprimand, he'd managed to cook up a vague sense of guilt for not rising to the occasion. He checked the phone and saw Zoe hadn't even opened his message. That was a bit strange. She was awake for sure, and Zoe was obsessive about checking her messages, doubly so now that Andrea was in danger. That annoying reporter had told him last night that Zoe had gone to grab dinner with a tall man. At the time, Tatum had thought she might have gone with Detective Foster for some reason. But now he wondered. Hearing the sound of the adjacent room's door opening, he hurried outside, intending to intercept Zoe before she left. He squinted in the sunlight, turning to Zoe's door. A man was just leaving her room, the door shutting behind him. Tall really was an apt description. The man towered even over Tatum. He scratched his beard and turned to leave, pausing when he saw Tatum. His eyes flickered for a moment to Tatum's feet, still clad in only one sock. He then brushed past, nodding at Tatum politely. Tatum checked the phone in his hand. Zoe still hadn't seen the text. He suddenly felt a stab of concern. Who was this man who'd just stepped out of her room? As he approached her door, he saw it hadn't quite shut, the latch jamming slightly. He knocked on the door.
Zoe? Are you there?
No answer. Not even after he knocked again. He hesitated, then pushed the door open. The room was empty, but Zoe's suitcase was on the floor. The bedsheets were tangled in a way that made him think of a violent struggle. He could hear water running from the bathroom.
Zoe!
He called out, and a second later, much louder.
Zoe, are you all right?
The running water stopped.
Tatum?
He heard her muffled voice through the door. He relaxed instantly. Then his mind interpreted everything again. The tangled sheets, the musky smell in the room, the man who'd left. He stood frozen, the simple jigsaw that he should have put together a few minutes before suddenly clicking in his mind.
Tatum? Is that you?
Zoe called from the bathroom again.
Yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to know if you need a ride to the airport.
He shuffled uncomfortably, feeling awkward.
Sorry, you didn't answer the phone and I thought...
He didn't finish the sentence. What had he thought? Why hadn't he conceived of the simple explanation that Zoe was momentarily indisposed?
I'd appreciate a ride, she said. I'll just be a minute.
Tatum was about to leave her room when Zoe's handbag grabbed his attention. It was open, and a gray folder peeked from inside. He took it out of her handbag and opened it. It was a copy of Nicole Medina's case file, with some notations marked in Zoe's handwriting inside. He flipped the pages, getting glimpses of the familiar crime scene photos. The bathroom door opened behind him.
Okay, I'm ready,
Zoe said. He turned around. Her hair was wet, her face paler than usual. A single drop of water ran down the side of her neck, and Tatum found his attention transfixed by it.
Oh, yeah, she said. Can you take the case files back to the police station? I forgot to return it before leaving.
Sure. Did you talk to Andrea this morning?
She's much better.
Zoe crouched and picked up her suitcase.
Your grandfather stayed the night, apparently.
What? At your apartment?
She said he made her feel safe.
She gave him a small smile. He's a sweet man.
That's Marvin,
Tatum muttered.
The sweetest.
She began walking, dragging the suitcase after her.
Let me,
Tatum offered. I'm fine. She shouldered her handbag, then glanced at his feet. Maybe you should finish putting your shoes on. Tatum stared dumbly at his partially clad feet.
Sure, it'll just take a moment.
Zoe brushed past him as she left the room. She smelled of the hotel shampoo. He hurriedly went to his room, putting on the other sock and the shoes. Then he left the room to follow Zoe. He hadn't gone to the bathroom or brushed his teeth since waking up, but he didn't want to ask her to wait. He'd have to avoid breathing on people until he could drop back by his hotel room.
I hate to leave in a hurry, but there isn't much we can do here, Zoe said as they climbed down the motel stairs.
You can help them with the press and kick off your hotline. Remember to make sure they have the Medina funeral closely watched. It should take place in a few days.
Right.
Serial killers sometimes showed up at their victims' funerals. It was good practice to take some photos of the funeral guests. I'll talk to you tonight. See how it's going.
Just take care of your sister.
He took the suitcase from her and hefted it into the trunk. They both slid into the car and shut the doors. He started the engine.
I met that reporter friend of yours yesterday.
Harry Berry? She looked alarmed. You didn't tell him about Andrea?
I didn't tell him anything,
Tatum answered. They drove through the streets of San Angelo, which was slowly waking up. Tatum thought of pointing out that it was his turn to choose the music, but couldn't find the words. It was as if the connection between Zoe and him had snapped, leaving them a couple of strangers. And maybe they were strangers after all. How long had he known her? A month? Was that really enough to know anyone? His phone rang. Keeping one hand on the wheel, he answered the call.
Gray here. Agent Gray.
It was Detective Foster.
The killer is streaming a new video. Experiment number 2. It's Maribel Howe. Damn! I'm sending you the link. Get over here.
He hung up and glanced at Zoe.
We'll have to get you an Uber.
What happened?
Experiment number 2.
His phone blipped. He pulled over by the sidewalk and glanced at the message. It was from Foster and contained a single link. Tatum tapped the link. The browser window opened slowly. The website was similar to the first, a video uploaded by Schrodinger, titled Experiment Number 2. For a while, they just stared at the black video screen, while the slow cellular connection accessed the stream. Then, suddenly, the face of a girl lying in the darkness appeared, the video in the same black and white hues of an infrared camera. She was yelling, thumping on something above her. The phone's speaker morphed the screams, making them sound grainy and inhuman.
That's Maribel Howe, Zoe said. I saw her photo.
I need to go to the station. Let me help you get your suitcase and...
No.
Zoe stared at the screen.
I'm coming with you.
Chapter 40 Maribel's voice on the phone had set Delia's life back in motion. She hadn't even noticed it had stopped until that call. Time had stood still for weeks on end while Delia waited for her daughter to return. She and Frank had stopped talking. She'd rarely left the house, hardly bothering with any semblance of a routine. Only the pain she'd inflicted on herself corresponded to the rules of time, its intensity ebbing as the minutes ticked by. But upon hearing her daughter screaming for help, she'd realized Maribel needed her help now. She and Frank had tried talking the night before, for the first time in 6 weeks. It had been a stunted conversation, full of pauses and half-finished sentences, as if their ability to communicate had gone stale after they'd left it untouched for too long. It had been a formal conversation, full of technicalities. What were the possibilities? How could they try to help Maribel? Frank, a man of action, had suggested hiring a private detective, kicking up a social media campaign and trying to schedule an interview on the local TV. Delia had agreed to everything he'd said, while resolving that she would go to the police station and demand that their daughter's disappearance get the attention it deserved. There was a sort of bitter irony there. Maribel had said more than once that Delia's nagging skills couldn't be matched. And now her own plan to help her daughter was essentially nagging the police to make an effort. She drove toward the police station, the window cranked open to let her cigarette smoke out. Since the phone call, she'd chain-smoked almost 2 boxes. The cigarette was held between the fingers of her right hand, which she used to shift gears as well, ash scattering everywhere. Her phone blipped in her pocket. Another reporter, probably. They'd been nagging her. She had no idea how they'd even found out about the call. Had someone in the police told them? Frank said it was good. They needed the public interest. So far, they had the public eye for sure. The San Angelo Standard Times had an article on Maribel on page 3. The bare facts were there. The phone call, the missing girl, an image of Maribel smiling, looking pure and beautiful. The press pointed accusing fingers at the police, who hadn't reacted when the girl had first gone missing. How long before they started wondering why Maribel had left home at 18? How long before the accusing fingers would shift from the police to the parents? She inhaled the smoke as she thought grimly of what she'd say when she got to the station. She had to make them see she'd never leave before they took her seriously. It was time to get Maribel back. Chapter 41. The detective division was frantic. The video of Maribel Howe played on multiple computers and phones, her shrieks emitting from everywhere, creating a chilling cacophony of distress. Tatum stood in the division's entrance, momentarily paralyzed, as Zoe brushed past him to Foster's cubicle. Tatum hurried after her, trying to ignore the guttural screams of the girl calling for her mother, begging to be let out. Foster was on the phone, shouting at someone, the video running on his computer. He hung up as they reached him. "When did this video go live?" Zoe demanded. He glanced at her.
25 minutes ago. People began getting the link by email soon after. He's sending it to a lot more people than before. Dispatch is swamped by phone calls.
Did you talk to Shelton?
Tatum asked.
Is he trying to trace the source of the video?
Lyons is on the phone with him right now,
Foster said.
We also sent 3 patrol cars to search the vicinity of Nicole Medina's gravesite in case he decided to bury Maribel nearby. And I just managed to get us permission to get a helicopter into the air. Maybe we'll catch sight of the bastard still shoveling dirt on top of her.
He didn't video himself this time, Zoe frowned. Maybe the burial site is easily recognizable. And he didn't want to give it away.
We can probably figure out areas that could be easier to spot,
Foster said.
Any familiar landmark would be a dead giveaway, right? I'll get someone on that right away.
He picked up the phone.
Foster!
Lyons shouted from her seat and launched from her chair.
He's using one of the phones from earlier.
Her voice was almost drowned completely by Maribel's screams.
What?
The phones he used!
Tatum raised his hand to stop her and then shouted at the top of his lungs.
Everyone, mute your goddamn videos now!
For a second, it seemed that no one had paid attention to him. But then, one by one, the scream stopped, until the room became reasonably quiet. Tatum shut his eyes in relief, unclenching his fists.
I just talked to Shelton.
Lyon's eyes were bright.
The killer is using the same phone as last time to stream this video. We have an approximate location. It's close to Route 67, just north of the Twin Buttes Reservoir, near the trailer park they have there.
She bent over his keyboard and tapped, getting a map on his screen.
Holy shit, we got him,
Foster spat, punching digits on his phone.
Dispatch, I need patrol cars on Route 67, and we need three roadblocks. One by the turn to Willikapit Road, one by the turn to South Jameson Road, and the third on that road that leads to the Twin Buttes Reservoir, just off 67. Yeah, that's the one. Don't let any car through until I give you further instructions. Got that? Not even the police chief. The entire area is sealed.
He hung up, his forehead furrowed.
How dangerous would he be when cornered?
He asked Tatum.
Should we be worried? He might try to run when cornered,
Tatum said.
But not if it means risking his life. It's more likely he'll try to bullshit his way out, claim he doesn't have anything to do with it, that sort of thing.
He glanced at Zoe for affirmation. She gave him a distracted nod, her attention elsewhere.
Everything we saw so far matches a killer that preys on the weak. He used a knife to intimidate Nicole Medina, which makes me think he doesn't even have a gun.
Lyon's desk phone rang and she went over to pick it up.
I'm going over to monitor the search,
Foster said.
I'd appreciate it if one of you would accompany me.
I'll go,
Tatum said.
We can.
Lyons slammed down the phone, her eyes wide.
Delia Howe is at the front desk.
Delia Howe? Zoe asked. Does she know about the video? Doesn't sound like it. I think she just wants to talk. Tatum looked around him, at the screens showing the girl struggling in the darkness, the detectives all working frantically to find her.
She can't get in here.
Chapter 42. Zoe and Lyons managed to get Delia Howe to an unused meeting room without her noticing the frantic activity in the station. They went over the details of the phone call that Delia had received from Maribel the day before. Zoe had difficulties picturing the exact situation, and she kept hoping for a random detail to shed some light on that phone call. As the interview went on, frustration grew inside her. Nothing here felt right. Lyons wrote down everything Delia said in a notebook. Delia seemed to get agitated as they went over the same details.
I told you that already, she suddenly snapped. I don't know why she hung up. Maybe she heard someone coming. Maybe someone took the phone from her. What are you people going to do about it? Are you even looking for her now?
Zoe's and Lyons' eyes met for a fragment of a second, but Delia seemed to catch the exchange, tensing up. Mrs. Howe, we are doing our best to find your daughter, Lyons said.
I don't believe you. I want to talk to someone else. I want to talk to the man in charge.
She massaged her wrist, and Zoe glanced at it. A new burn mark marred Delia's skin, larger than last time. But no bruises around the wrist. No one had forced Delia's hand onto the blame. As Lyons tried to calm the woman down, Zoe attempted to put the sequence of events into order again. 6 weeks before, on July 29th, Maribel Howe had disappeared, presumably taken by the unsub. Then, on September 8th, Maribel managed to get to a phone and call her mother. One day later, the unsub buried her alive and published the video. Had he kept her imprisoned all that time?
I want to talk to someone else right now, Delia Howe shrieked, banging the table.
A sliver of truth floated just beyond her reach. She had to concentrate and couldn't do it in there.
Excuse me.
She got up, leaving the room, shutting the door behind her. She leaned against the hallway's wall, deep in thought. Suppose he'd held the girl captive for more than a month, and then she'd managed to escape, calling her mother. As retribution, he'd buried her alive. It was a good explanation, but it didn't fit. Why did he keep Maribel imprisoned while Nicole Medina was buried immediately after being taken? Maybe Maribel hadn't been kidnapped. Maybe she'd really left home, and then the killer had kidnapped her recently from wherever she'd been staying. But that seemed far-fetched. Why had she disappeared so suddenly, leaving everything she owned behind her? That phone call was strange as well. Delia Howe was adamant that she hadn't informed the press about it. Maybe her husband had, or maybe there was a leak from the police. But there was so much detail in the news articles about the call, detail that only Delia could know. It was possible that the killer had leaked the details, but it didn't seem to fit either. If he'd buried her as retribution for trying to escape and calling her mother, he wouldn't draw attention to his own carelessness. Lyons got out of the room and stepped over to Zoe. What's going on?
Something here is wrong. Do you think Maribel was imprisoned by the killer all this time?
I'm almost sure of it. That's the best explanation.
Why?
I don't know yet, Zoe. Maybe he used her body. Maybe he enjoyed talking to her. Maybe he liked her cooking skills. We'll ask her when we find her.
Why didn't he keep Nicole Medina?
Why change the pattern so drastically? Why keep Maribel for so long only to bury her too?
Maybe because he's a sadistic psychopath, Lyons suggested.
It doesn't work like that, Zoe said slowly. The unsub doesn't do stuff because he wants to spread misery. He's not possessed by the devil. Everything he does is propelled by need. Some of it is his sexual need. He has an elaborate sexual fantasy in his mind. And these acts, burying women alive, are the consequence of that fantasy. He also seems to want attention. The attention of the press and the police. Fame.
A detail in the video had snagged her attention, but she couldn't put her finger on it. Like a shadow glimpsed by the corner of her eye, gone as soon as she turned to face it.
We can figure that out later, Lyons said. Right now, we need to finish this interview and...
The word died on her lips as she turned to the door of the meeting room. Zoe followed her eyes. The door was slightly open and the room was empty. While they'd been talking, Delia had slid out and left. They both took off running after the woman. Delia brushed past a pair of cops, then darted to the right, straight through the door labeled
Detective Division. Zoe and Lyons caught up with her a second later. She stood at the division's entrance, staring at the various screens displaying her daughter's crying face. Though the videos were muted now, the impact of the picture was enough. Delia's eyes were wide, her lips trembling.
That's Maribel.
Lyons grabbed her arm gently. Mrs. Howe, please come with me. The woman tore her arm away, never shifting her eyes from the screens.
What's going on?
Lyons answered, but Zoe didn't pay attention. Now, watching alongside the girl's mother, she finally realized what had bothered her about the video. The girl had a smear of mascara on her face. But if the killer really had taken her 6 weeks ago, there was no good reason for her to wear any makeup. Not unless the killer had demanded it from her. And eyeing the girl's shirt, a strapless green top, Zoe could think of one reason. Chapter 43. It was the first time since Tatum had landed in Texas that the heat was getting to him. A bead of sweat ran down his forehead and into his right eye, making it sting. Foster approached, handing him a large bottle of water. Tatum took it gratefully and drank half of it in one go.
How long do you think she has?
Foster asked, his eyes glazed. Tatum shrugged. They'd gone through similar conversations 3 times in the past hour. They had no way to know, even if they knew the exact time she'd been shut in the box. As far as he could tell from the video, Maribel was actually doing the one thing that could increase her chances of survival. She now lay still, consuming less oxygen from the very limited amount around her. Foster's phone blipped.
Oh, damn it, he snapped. The press have the story.
He showed Tatum the screen. It was an article titled, Police Searching for Girl Buried Alive. A frame from the video was placed directly under the headline. Maribel Howe's face paused mid-scream.
Soon they'll connect it to the Nicole Medina case, and we'll have a panicked population to handle.
Tatum glanced at his own phone, where the video still ran.
He didn't stop the video feed yet, he remarked. It's almost 2 hours long. What do you think it means?
Hell if I know,
Tatum said tiredly.
Zoe would say his fantasy is evolving.
The constant sound of faraway honking set his teeth on edge. Route 67 was a few dozen yards away, and 2 police blockades had split it into 3 sections, resulting in long standstill traffic jams in either direction. Though they let vehicles pass, they did it slowly, writing down the license plate of each car. He stared at the lines of traffic, the sun glinting off their windshields, then turned around to survey the entire search perimeter. It was a plateau of sand and gravel, spotted with dry shrubs and bare trees. A trailer park stood by the road, its inhabitants gathering with interest to watch the police search. Beyond it, he could barely glimpse a gas station. A long railway ran parallel to the road a few yards apart. Having studied the map, Tatum knew this railway and the road didn't diverge. Several patrol officers were combing the ground with metal detectors, though all they'd found so far were beer cans. A canine handler, who'd introduced himself as Jones, was searching by the trailer park with his dog, Buster. On the other side of the perimeter, a technician was pushing a ground-penetrating radar over the gravel. It didn't look like a complex piece of technology. In fact, it was similar to a lawnmower. The radar technician seemed to struggle with the endless rocks, shrubs, and cacti in his way. As Tatum watched, he stopped, shaking his head, and took a step away from his machine. He walked over, his shoulders slumped.
Now what?
Foster grunted.
The GPR can't penetrate deep here,
the man said.
Too much clay in the soil? What kind of excuse is that?
Foster asked.
The clay interferes with the radar's effectiveness. You said this baby of yours can see 50 feet deep, so what are you talking about? Only 15 feet?